Welcome to Maplewood Barn Radio Theater. Come on in and sit a while. Relax while we tell a story or two. Actually, it might be best not to relax over much. For this Halloween week broadcast of our new KBIA show, we've chosen to bring you two appropriately terrifying short stories by none other than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The man who brought us The Hound of the Baskervilles certainly knew how to tell a tense tale, even without Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Our first story, The New Catacomb, takes you to Rome and the rooms of a young British scientist named Kennedy. He is entertaining a colleague called Berger. The night was cold. Outside, under the bright winter stars, lay modern Rome. On the rug between them stood a long, shallow fruit basket, littered with objects, inscribed tiles, torn papyri, rusty metal ornaments, which to the uninitiated might have seemed to have come straight from a dustman's bin, but which a specialist would have immediately recognized as unique. It was the German, Berger, who had brought them in, and the Englishman Kennedy's eyes were hungry as he looked at them.
"Look here, Berger. I do wish that you would confide in me. I won't interfere with your treasure trove, but I should very much like to hear about it. It is evidently a discovery of the first importance. These inscriptions will make a sensation throughout Europe."
"For everyone here, there are a million there. There are so many that a dozen savants might spend a lifetime over them, Kennedy, and build up a reputation as solid as the castle of St. Angelo."
"You have given yourself away, Berger. Your words can only apply to one thing. You have discovered a new catacomb."
"I had no doubt that you had already come to that conclusion from an examination of these objects."
"Where?"
"Ah, that is my secret, my dear Kennedy. Suffice it to say that it is so situated that there is not one chance in a million of anyone else coming upon it. Its date is different from that of any known catacomb, and it has been reserved for the burial of the highest Christians, so that the remains and the relics are quite different from anything which has ever been seen before. If I was not aware of your knowledge and your energy, my friend, I would not hesitate, under the pledge of secrecy, to tell you everything about it. But as it is, I think that I must certainly prepare my own report of the matter before I expose myself to such formidable competition."
"Look here, Berger. I assure you that you can trust me most implicitly in the matter."
"I have noticed, friend Kennedy, that when I want information from any point, you are not always so ready to supply it."
"When did you ever ask me anything that I did not tell you? You remember, for example, my giving you the material for your paper about the Temple of the Vestals."
"Well, then, tell me all about your relations with Miss Mary Saunderson."
"What the devil do you mean? What sort of a question is this? You may mean it as a joke, but you never made a worse one."
"No, I don't mean it as a joke. I really am rather interested in the details of the matter. I don't know much about the world and women and social life and that sort of thing, and such an incident has a fascination of the unknown for me. I know you, and I knew her by sight. I had even spoken to her once or twice. I should very much like to hear from your own lips exactly what it was which occurred between you."
"I won't tell you a word. You know we look upon a man who kisses and tells as the greatest coward and villain possible."
"That's all right. It was only my whim to see if you would give up a secret as easily as you expected me to give up my secret of the new catacomb. You wouldn't, and I didn't expect you to. But why should you expect otherwise of me? There's St. John's clock striking 10. It is quite time I was going home."
"Wait a bit, Berger. I am very keen upon this catacomb business, and I can't let it drop quite so easily. Would you mind asking me something else in return? Something not quite so eccentric this time?"
"No, no, you have refused, and there's an end of it. No doubt you are quite right not to answer, and no doubt I am quite right also. And so again, my dear Kennedy, good night."
"Hold on, old fellow. I think you are behaving in a most ridiculous fashion. But still, if this is your condition, I suppose that I must submit to it. I hate saying anything about a girl, but it is all over Rome, and I don't suppose I can tell you anything which you do not know already. What was it you wanted to know?"
"May I have another cigar?" "Thank you very much. I never smoke when I work, but I enjoy a chat much more when I am under the influence of tobacco. Now, as regards this young lady with whom you had this little adventure, what in the world has become of her?"
She is at home with her own people, in Twickenham.
You must excuse my curiosity, my dear Kennedy, and you must put it down to my ignorance of the world. No doubt it is quite a simple thing to persuade a lady to go off with you for 3 weeks or so, and then to hand her over to her own family at, what did you call that place?
Twickenham.
Quite so, Twickenham. But it is something so entirely outside my own experience that I cannot even imagine how you would set about it. For example, if you had loved this girl, your love could hardly disappear in 3 weeks, so I presume that you could not have loved her at all. But if you did not love her, why should you make this great scandal which has damaged you and ruined her?
That's a logical way of looking at it, certainly. Love is a big word, and it represents a good many different shades of feeling. I liked her, and, well, you say you've seen her. You know how charming she can look. But still, I am willing to admit, looking back, that I could never have really loved her.
Then, my dear Kennedy, why did you do it?
The adventure of the thing had a great deal to do with it.
What? You are so fond of adventures?
Where would the variety of life be without them? It was for an adventure that I first began to pay my attentions to her. I've chased a good deal of game in my time, but there's no chase like that of a pretty woman. On top of all the other obstacles which attracted me, I learned from her own lips very early in the proceedings that she was engaged.
My God, to whom?
She mentioned no names.
I do not think that anyone knows that. So that made the adventure more alluring, did it?
Well, it certainly gave a spice to it, don't you think so?
I tell you that I am very ignorant about these things.
My dear fellow, you can remember that the apple you stole from your neighbor's tree was always sweeter than that which fell from your own. And then I found that she cared for me.
At once?
Oh, no. It took about 3 months of sapping and mining. But at last I won her over. She understood that my judicial separation from my wife made it impossible for me to do the right thing by her. But she came all the same, and we had a delightful time, as long as it lasted.
But how about the other man?
I suppose it is the survival of the fittest. If he had been the better man, she would not have deserted him. Let's drop the subject, for I have had enough of it.
Only one other thing. How did you get rid of her in 3 weeks?
Well, we had both cooled down a bit, you understand. She absolutely refused, under any circumstances, to come back to face the people she had known in Rome. Now, of course, Rome is necessary to me, and I was already pining to be back at my work. So there was one obvious cause of separation. Then again, her old father turned up at the hotel in London, and there was a scene, and the whole thing became so unpleasant that really, though I missed her dreadfully at first, I was very glad to slip out of it. Now, I rely upon you not repeating anything of what I have just said.
My dear Kennedy, I should not dream of repeating it. But all that you say interests me very much, for it gives me an insight into your way of looking at things, which is entirely different from mine, for I have seen so little of life. And now you want to know about my catacomb. There's no use in trying to describe her, for you would never find it by that. There is only one thing, and that is for me to take you there.
That would be splendid. Shall we go?
Certainly. I think the place where we turn off is somewhere here. Yes, this is it, around the corner of the trattoria. Now, it is a very narrow path, so perhaps I had better go in front and you can follow. Let me light the lantern. Ah, here we are.
Surely your catacomb is not inside this solitary wooden cowhouse.
The entrance to it is. That is just the safeguard which we have against anyone else discovering it.
Does the proprietor know of it?
Not he. He had found one or two objects which made me almost certain that his house was built on the entrance of such a place. So I rented it from him and did my excavations for myself. Come in and shut the door behind you. I will turn down the lantern. It might excite remark if anyone saw a light in this lonely place. Just help me to move this boarding. Here are the old stone steps leading down to the catacombs. Not so fast, Kennedy. Be careful. It is a perfect rabbit's warren below, and if you want to lose your way there, the chances would be 100 to 1 against ever coming out again. Wait until I bring a light.
How do you find your own way if it's so complicated?
I had some very narrow escapes at first, but I have gradually learned to go about. There is a certain system to it, but it is one which a lost man, if he were in the dark, could not possibly find out. Even now, I always spin out a ball of string behind me when I am going far into the catacomb. I want you to follow me closely, my friend. Do not loiter to look at anything upon the way, for the place which I will take you to contains all that you can see, and more. It'll save time for us to go there direct.
This is amazing. Everywhere I look, I see shriveled mummies, inscriptions, funeral vessels, pictures, vestments, utensils. This must have been one of the earliest and finest of the Christian catacombs.
Yes.
It contains a storehouse of remains and artifacts, such as I have never seen before.
The pristine nature of the catacombs is quite incredible. Come along, do not tarry.
It is quite a labyrinth. What would happen if the light went out?
I have a spare candle and a box of matches in my pocket. By the way, Kennedy, have you any matches?
No. You'd better give me some.
Oh, that is all right. There's no chance of our separating, so long as you stay close.
By Jove. It is a Christian altar. Probably the first one in existence. Here is the little consecration cross cut upon the corner of it. No doubt this circular space was used as a church.
Precisely. If I had more time, I should like to show you all the bodies which are buried in these niches upon the walls, for they are the early popes and bishops of the church, with their mitres, their croziers, and full canonicals. Go over to that one and look at it. The ghastly head lays loosely on a shredded and mouldering mitre.
This is most interesting. As far as my experience goes, it is unique. Bring the lantern over, Berger, for I want to see them all. Berger, where are you going? Bring the light over here.
Do you know how many wrong turnings there are between this and the stairs? There are over 2,000. No doubt it was one of the means of protection which the Christians adopted. The odds are 2,000 to 1 against a man getting out, even if he had a light. But if he were in the dark, it would be, of course, far more difficult.
So I should think.
The darkness is something dreadful. I tried it once for an experiment. Let us try it again.
That will do, Berger. The point is well made. The darkness is quite complete. Let's have the light again.
You seem uneasy, friend Kennedy.
Go on, man, light the candle.
It's very strange, Kennedy, but I could not tell in the least by the sound in which direction you stand. Could you tell where I am?
No. You seem to be on every side of me. It's like an echo chamber.
If it were not for this string which I hold in my hand, I should not have a notion of about which way to go.
I dare say not. Strike a light, man, and have an end of this nonsense.
Well, Kennedy, there are two things that I understand you are very fond of. The one is adventure, and the other is an obstacle to surmount. The adventure must be of finding your way out of this catacomb. The obstacle will be the darkness and the 2,000 wrong turns, which make the way a little difficult to find. But you need not hurry, for you have plenty of time, and when you halt for a rest now and then, I should like you just to think about Miss Mary Saunderson, and whether you treated her quite fairly.
You devil, what do you mean?
Goodbye. I really do not think, Kennedy, even by your own showing that you did the right thing by that girl. There was only one little thing which you appeared not to know, and I can supply it. Miss Saunderson was engaged to a poor, ungainly devil of a student, and his name was Julius Berger.
No, Berger! No! No!
Some 2 months afterwards, the following made the round of the European press. One of the most interesting discoveries of recent years is that of the new catacomb in Rome. The finding of this important burial place is due to the energy and sagacity of Dr. Julius Berger, who is rapidly taking the first place as an authority upon ancient Rome. Although the first to publish this discovery, it appears that a less fortunate adventurer had anticipated Dr. Berger. Some months ago, Mr. Kennedy, the well-known English scientist, disappeared suddenly from his rooms, and it was conjectured that his association with a recent scandal had driven him to leave Rome. It now appears that he had in reality fallen a victim to that fervid love of archaeology which had raised him to a distinguished place among living scholars. His body was discovered in the heart of the new catacomb, and it was evident from the condition of his feet and boots that he had tramped for days through the tortuous corridors which make these subterranean tombs so dangerous to explorers. What makes the matter more painful is that Dr. Julius Berger was an intimate friend of the deceased. His joy at the extraordinary find, which he has been so fortunate as to make, has been greatly marred by the terrible fate of his comrade and fellow worker. We hope you've enjoyed the production of The New Catacomb. Now let's catch our breaths for a moment before moving on to the next Conan Doyle story.
This Halloween, are you ready to be scared just a little by Columbia's historical and hysterical spooks in Nifong Park? Join the ghosties and ghoulies of Maplewood Barn Players as they populate the Nifong Mansion on October 31st from 6 to 9 p.m. Consult MaplewoodBarn.com for details. This haunting is co-sponsored by the Boone County Historical Society and D&H Drug Stores. Bring the whole family.
Our next Halloween treat is The Case of Lady Sannox, also written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and published in 1923. We hope you get a few shivers from this Maplewood Barn Theater production, brought to you with the kind assistance of KBIA Radio. The illicit relationship between famed surgeon Douglas Stone and the notoriously promiscuous Lady Sannox was very well known. In fact, they did nothing to hide it. Frequenting restaurants, going to the theater, attending receptions and such like as if they were married. Lord Sannox, the lady's husband, was a mild-mannered fellow who seemed to not notice or not care that his wife displayed profligate tendencies. There was naturally, therefore, a widespread interest in when the strange facts you were about to hear became public. Our story begins on a dismal winter's night, very cold and gusty, with the wind whooping in the chimneys and blustering against the window panes. Dr. Stone had just returned to his apartment for the evening, where he is greeted by his valet.
Good evening, sir. May I take your coat? My, you seem in high spirits tonight, sir. Was it a good day?
Yes, indeed, Higby. I am very well pleased, for against the advice of 6 colleagues, I performed an extremely difficult operation which was brilliant beyond all expectations. The doctors who witnessed the procedure were amazed at my daring and excellence with the scalpel, if I may be allowed a bit of self-puffery.
Very good, Dr. Stone. Another triumph. Are you staying in tonight, sir? Should I begin preparing dinner?
No, Higby. I have promised Lady Sannox that I will meet her at the Effringham Ball this evening, and it is already 8:30. I just have time to freshen up and change into evening dress, and I will be on my way.
At the risk of being presumptuous, sir, do you really think that is wise? Lady Sannox is a married woman and well known in the upper echelons of society. Perhaps it would be best
Higby, that is a bit presumptuous. Lady Sannox and I have been seeing each other for quite some time, and it has never caused any problem outside of some idle gossip. Her husband is quite the homebody and does not seem to care that we...
Excuse me, sir. A patient to see you, sir, in the consulting room.
About himself?
No, sir. I think he wants you to go out.
It is too late. I won't go.
This is his card, sir.
Hamil Ali Habib. The fellow is a Turk, I suppose?
Yes, sir. It seems as if he came from abroad, sir. His face is swarthy, with hair and beard of the deepest black, and he's in a terrible way.
Well, I hate to disappoint the gentleman, but I do have an engagement.
He seems quite agitated, sir.
All right, Higby, I'll see him. Show him in here. Good evening. You speak English, I presume?
Yes, sir. I am from Asia Minor, but I can speak English if we speak slowly.
You wanted me to go out, I understand.
Yes, sir. I wanted very much that you should see my wife.
I could come in the morning, but I have an engagement which prevents me from seeing your wife tonight.
It is a terrible situation. I am prepared to offer 100 pounds, and I promise that it will not take you an hour. I have a cab ready at the door.
I see it is a matter of great importance to you. What is the case?
Oh, it is so sad a one. So sad a one. You have not, perhaps, heard of the daggers of the Almohades?
Never.
Ah, they are eastern daggers of great age and of a singular shape, with the hilt like what you call a stirrup. I am a curiosity dealer, you see, and that is why I have come to England. But next week I go back once more. Many things I brought with me, and I have a few things left. But among them, to my sorrow, is one of these daggers.
You will remember that I have an appointment, sir. Pray confine yourself to the necessary details.
You will see that it is urgent. Today my wife fell down in a faint in the room where I keep my wares, and she cut her lower lip upon this cursed dagger of Almohades.
I see, and you wish me to dress the wound?
No, no. It is worse than that.
What then?
These daggers are poisoned.
Poisoned?
Yes, and there is no man, east or west, who can tell now what is the poison or what the cure might be. What little is known about these weapons was told to me by my father, who was in the trade before me.
What are the symptoms?
Deep sleep and death in 30 hours.
And you say there is no cure. Why then should you pay me this considerable fee?
No drug can cure. But the knife may.
What are you proposing?
The poison is slow of absorption. It remains for hours in the wound.
Washing, then, might cleanse it?
No more than in a snake bite. It is too subtle and too deadly.
Excision of the wound, then?
That is it. If it be on the finger, take the finger off. So said my father. But think of where this wound is, and that it is my wife. It is dreadful.
Yes, well, I am a surgeon, and have familiarity with such grim matters. Higby, fetch my instrument bag. I must waste no time if I am to consummate my appointment this evening.
Your bag, sir.
Will you take a glass of wine before we go? It sometimes helps steel the nerves, especially in a case such as this.
You forget that I am a Muslim, and a true follower of the Prophet. I am prohibited from drinking intoxicating beverages. But tell me, what is the bottle of green glass which you have placed in your pocket?
It is chloroform.
Ah, that also is forbidden to us. It is a spirit, and we make no use of such things.
What? You would allow your wife to go through such an operation without an anesthetic?
Ah, she will feel nothing, poor soul. The deep sleep has already come on, which is the first working of the poison. And then I have given her of our traditional medicine, opium. Come, sir, for already an hour has passed.
Let's be off, then. There's not a moment to lose.
As they stepped out into the darkness, a sheet of rain was driven in upon them, and the hall lamp went out with a puff. An instant later, they were rattling upon their journey. Soon, they arrived at a mean-looking house in a narrow and sordid street.
Lead me to the patient.
Please, follow me, Dr. Stone. She is in here.
What is this veil she is wearing?
It is called a yashmak. You know our views about women in the East. Please forgive the necessity of keeping her face covered. The yashmak leaves the lower half of her face exposed, so it should not interfere.
Yes. I see a jagged cut zigzagging along her underlip. That is it?
Yes. That is the poisoned wound.
The disfigurement will be frightful.
I can understand that the mouth will not be a pretty one to kiss.
The effects of this surgery will include an inability to control saliva, difficulty eating, and possibly the loss of teeth due to exposure.
As I said before, the loss of a lip is better than the loss of a life.
Come, hold the lamp closer so that I can see clearly. There will be a lot of blood. Do you have a towel at hand?
Yes, it is here.
All right. The forceps will be used to grasp the wounded lip, like so, and extend it as far as possible. Then the scalpel will be applied to make two swift incisions and remove the affected area, this broad V-shaped piece of flesh, down to the gums. Are you ready, sir?
Yes. Please proceed.
Good Lord! I thought you said she would feel nothing! Please, madam! She has swooned. That is fortunate. But what weight? Her face covering has been torn away. Oh my God! Marion! Darling! What have I done? This is my love! The room is swelling. I must sit. What is this? A false beard and hair? But...
That is correct, Dr. Stone. It is I, Lord Sanix. It was really very necessary for Marion, this operation. Not physically, but morally, you know, morally. Are you all right, Doctor? I had long intended to make a little example. Your note of Wednesday miscarried, and I have it here in my pocketbook. I took some pains in carrying out my idea. The wound, by the way, was from nothing more dangerous than my signet ring. You see, you have kept your appointment after all. I had intended at this point to shoot you, Dr. Stone, but it appears that you have been sufficiently chastised. You may laugh, Doctor, but I fail to see the humor. Oh, and one last thing. You are welcome to take her lip with you. Perhaps it will give you some little comfort. You may caress it whenever you wish, as you have done so many times before.
The next day, Lady Sanix entered a convent, never to be seen again by her friends and acquaintances. Dr. Stone was admitted into an asylum for the mentally unhinged. Lord Sanix returned from Rome several months afterward in search of a new bride. We hope you have enjoyed these two Halloween stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which were adapted for radio by Brad Buchanan. Our producer is Darren Helwich. Our players were Chris Bowling as Berger and later Dr. Stone. Aaron Hunsley was Kennedy and later the Turk, Lord Sanix, and Brad Buchanan was the valet and cabbie in our second story. This is your narrator, Byron Scott, hoping you will join us next week at the same time for more entertaining stories from the Maplewood Barn Radio Theater. On behalf of all of us, happy Halloween, and just one final word. Boo!